Hi everyone, thank you very much for coming. There's a lot to talk about. I'm going to be really brief to leave space for Sahar and Mahmoud to talk. I just want to introduce Sumud. Sumud is a political prisoner solidarity group focusing on Palestinian political prisoners. We've been working on this tour for about a year now. Sahar has basically gone to New York, New Jersey, Washington DC, Chicago, Detroit, Ann Arbor, San Francisco, Los Angeles, Toronto, Hamilton, and now here. And this is the last leg. This is the last talk she's going to be giving on this tour. I'm sure it's been long and arduous, but she's pulled through. Part of what we wanted to do was basically to connect Palestinian solidarity groups with political prisoners, solidarity groups, and also to connect with people working on immigrant and refugee issues, just in terms of highlighting the risk that Palestinians do face if returned to Palestine. If deported to Palestine, and I'm really glad that the organizers decided to get someone from the Coalition Against Deportation of Palestinian Refugees to start off the event today and make that link. The main campaign that Samud is working on is the Red Cross campaign, and it's one of the things we've tried to highlight throughout the tour with the different cities that Sahar has visited and other cities as well. And it might seem a little strange, why would we pick the Red Cross as something to campaign against? The International Committee of the Red Cross is set up to protect or to enforce the Geneva Conventions, or make sure that monitor how states adhere to the Geneva Conventions. And Israel is one of the main violators of the Fourth Geneva Convention. So the Red Cross basically does everything in secret. They'll visit jails, they'll take their reports, but nothing is made public. And even though a state like Israel continues to violate the laws, the Red Cross will still not take public action. And this isn't just with Palestine, this is with cases everywhere. Actually, the Red Cross also has access to immigrant refugee jails here as well. So for example, with the Abu Ghraib prison craziness, the Red Cross had already filed a report about the abuses in Abu Ghraib, and they didn't take public action against the US government for what was going on in Abu Ghraib. And what happened was when the atrocities inside the prison became public, actually most of the employees of the Red Cross in the Washington office resigned because the Red Cross hadn't taken such public action. So they basically say that they maintain the right to go public, but they don't even have a procedure that they could be held accountable for when they go public with these kinds of things. The Red Cross also acts as kind of the intermediary between the prisoners' families, and the administration of the jails. And so it actually has a lot of power and a lot of clout in ensuring that the prisoners get medical supplies, that they get clothing, blankets, glasses if their glasses break, all these kinds of basic needs that the prisoners have. And while they have sort of fulfilled that role in the past, they're actually really not fulfilling their mandate at all right now. And it continues to get worse. And they actually do have the ability to make conditions better in the prison, but they don't do it. And so we have this campaign going on. To learn more about it, you can visit the Sumud website, which is on all of our literature, and on the t-shirt, which I encourage you to buy. And there are postcards out there which you basically just write your name in and send them to the Red Cross. So we hope that people participate, write letters to the Red Cross, just basically make sure they know that people are watching them. We've been working on it for the past year, and we've actually seen some pretty major, sort of like they seem very shaken. We've delivered letters in several cities across the world, in North America, Europe, Palestine, and Australia. And this year we did it as well on April 18th. So things are kind of moving, and there were four actions across North America targeting the Red Cross. So I hope people will just kind of include that in the Palestine solidarity work and the prison solidarity work that they do here. And please send postcards and buy t-shirts. Thanks.
Thank you, Hassan. Our next speaker is Sahar Francis, who is a Palestinian lawyer with the Ramallah-based organization Al-Damir.
Thank you for coming to hear us today. Actually, I'm, like Hazem said, it's my last lecture today about political prisoners. I would like to start a little bit briefly about our work in Al-Damir. Adamir is a Palestinian non-governmental organization located in Ramallah, and we are working with political prisoners under the Israeli authorities and also in the Palestinian territory. We follow the cases of the torture, the imprisonment. Of course, we support the prisoners through representing them in the military courts, in the interrogation centers, and we do visit them monthly in their prisons to follow the daily conditions, the violations that they will face. We also have program to support the families through educating them about their rights, the visits and other issues related to the arrest of their relatives. We have also a program for the lawyers and other people who could be interested in working with the issue of the prisoners, training them how to apply the international standards in the in our work in the field. We also have do campaigns to release specific political prisoners. Later I will explain about one campaign that now we are working on for a woman in prison. Actually, why we started all this work of educating people coming here to the United States and also to Canada to talk about the issue of the political prisoners. We believe that the issue of the political prisoners should be put in the same level as all the other basic issues in the Palestinian-Israeli conflict. I mean, like the right of return of the refugees, the settlements, the wall that Israel is constructing now, East Jerusalem, and all the other basic things in the negotiation when the two sides have to negotiate. Because our experience from the Oslo agreement time shows that the Palestinians failed to release all these political prisoners. Like in 1993, when they negotiated with the Israelis and they get to sign the Oslo agreement, actually the Israelis enforced the Palestinian Authority to accept some conditions in the case of the prisoners, how to release them. And then they refused. Okay, I'll try. Then the Israelis, as I said, put conditions. They refused to release anybody with blood on his hand, anybody who was involved in military activities who caused injured, anybody who was sentenced for life sentence. And when the 8 years of Oslo ended, we had 1,500 political prisoners inside the Israeli prisons. And we are afraid, and we are almost sure that in this time also, and now the Palestinian side would be the weakest side in the negotiation, they would face the same reality. They will not succeed to enforce Israel to treat these prisoners as prisoners of war or as civilians who were resisting the occupation. In other words, to apply the international law in the case of the political prisoners and to release them. Actually, Israel denies the applicability of the humanitarian law and the human rights in the occupied territories, not just in the case of the political prisoners. They are not applying the Fourth Geneva Convention. And this is why, actually, they are not giving the status of civilians who were resisting occupation for these political prisoners, and they just deal them as criminal people. And this is why also they violated the international law in 1995 when they moved all these political prisoners from the occupied territories to inside Israel. They are not allowed to move, according to the Fourth Geneva Convention, the occupied people from the occupied territory to the state, the occupier. And they violated it. And actually, we believe that the Israelis were using the imprisonment as a policy against the Palestinians, as another kind of oppression against the whole community. It's not just talking about punishment for special cases, because they are using the policy of the imprisonment against a huge number of this community. Actually, since 67, since the occupation, they arrested till now more than 650,000 Palestinians. more than 40% of the males in the Palestinian community, which it means that they are using this and of course taking in account all the procedures of the arrest, with the torture, with the imprisonment, with the conditions in the prisons, with the humiliation that they are using against these people to broke their soul, the disconnecting that they are doing between these prisoners and their community. Because if we look about these prisoners, most of them, they are the political leaders, they are teachers, some of them, they are lecturers, doctors, they are social workers, they are students, they are juveniles, they are women. They are very important for the rebuilding now of the Palestinian community, and what Israel is doing now, they are totally separating them from their community, and of course they aim to break the soul of the resistant in the Palestinian community. I'll give you a little bit details about the legal situation for these political prisoners. We have totally two different systems inside Israel. Inside Israel, there's the civil system, and inside the occupied territories, it's a military system governed by military orders that the military governor legalized. So it's totally different. According, for example, the procedures of the arrest, when they come to arrest you at the first moment, they have the right to arrest you in the occupied territories for 8 days without bringing you in front of any judge, while in Israel it's 24 hours that they have to bring you in front of the court. And it applies also for the juveniles, like they can arrest a juvenile under age 16 or 18 for 8 days without bringing him in front of a judge. While they can, after the arrest, at the beginning of the arrest, they will start torturing you by beating, by humiliating, by also attacking your family member at the house, by searching, breaking things in the house. They will transfer you to the detention centers. There's 9 detention centers in the occupied territories. You would be sometimes isolated, as you saw in the movie. Rakan was isolated all the time when he was held in Atzion detention center. And after the 8 days of detention, you could be transferred to interrogation, or if they have enough evidences, they can bring you directly in front of the court or send you to the administrative detention. If they transfer you to the interrogation, theoretically they have the right to interrogate you for 180 days, while in the Israeli law it's 30 days before charging you, and in juvenile cases it's 20 days. In the military orders, actually, till the first 90 days they have to bring special authorization from the legal advisors that they need more than 90 days, and this is how they can get another 90 days. And in the interrogation, the Israelis, since the beginning of the occupation, they were using the torture, the physical torture and psychological torture against most of the Palestinian prisoners. More than 90% of the political prisoners were subjected of torture, especially in the 70s and in the 80s. And at the beginning of the occupation, they were using the physical torture by different kind of tying to small chairs, to water pipes on the wall or in the roof for a couple of days, sometimes shaking, sometimes cold showers, or putting you in a very small cell that you would stand all the time without having the opportunity to sit or to sleep. And the cell would be dark for a couple of days, and they were also using grape by stick and by bottles. Some of the detainees died in those years under the interrogation. In 1987, they started to make it more legal. They get the permit from the government committee called Landau Committee, says that the interrogators can use physical moderate pressure and psychological moderate pressure against the Palestinian political prisoners. And they were renewing this permission every 3 months by governmental decision, till 1999, when the Supreme Court in Israel decided that there's no more using of these ways. They said that these ways of interrogation are illegal, but they never called these ways torture. They still used the frame of physical moderate pressure. And also they kept the door open for the ticking bomb cases, which it means that they gave a protection for the interrogators to use torture in ticking bomb cases and still not be accused in front of a civil court out of using the torture. Actually, in 1995, a detainee died of the shaking. Abdelsamad Ehrezat, his neck was broken because the interrogator shaked him for 2 minutes and he died. Now they are more developing ways of how to torture and not leaving marks on the bodies, especially now after the decision of the High Court. They are using the psychological torture by isolation for in your cell, totally disconnected from the outside world, even meeting your lawyer. And according to the military orders, they can forbidden you from meeting your lawyer for up till 60 days. While in Israel, it's a couple of hours. The most longest time is 15 days. And in this time, you would be alone, just facing the interrogators who speaks Hebrew and not Arabic. With they can send you to the collaborators' room, or they can threaten you that they are going to demolish your house or arrest your family member, bringing them to the interrogation, or assassinate one of your family members. And as you said, so in the movie, it will be very effective against the juveniles, especially the juveniles. Israel also violates the international law in the definition of the juveniles. Inside the Israeli system, it's according to the international law. Juvenile would be somebody who are under age 18. While in the military orders, a juvenile is defined that he's somebody under age 16. It means that between age 14 and 16, they will treat you as a juvenile, and when you will be sent to prison, they will keep you in different prison for the juveniles in separate section. But between age 16 and 18, you would be treated as the same as the adults, sent to the same prisons with the adults. And actually, the trial of the juveniles, the court is the same military court for the adults. It's not a special court for the juveniles as the system inside Israel. Inside Israel, it's totally separate court. And also inside Israel, they have a process of rehabilitation, of social and psychological protection. So the judge, not in every case, have to send you for prison. He can choose to send you for a rehabilitation center or for protection center, for an open center that you can go back to sleep at your home, or a closed one. While in the Palestinian case, the juveniles case, it's like very rare, and actually in the last 5 years it was just Rakan, the first one, who was sent to this open center under the Palestinian Authority, and still just because he was like between 12 and 13, he was very young. And like taking the sentences, comparing with the charges, according to the military orders, throwing a stone, you can be sentenced for 10 years. And most of these juveniles that are arrested because they were involved in throwing stones, they would be sentenced for more than 8 months, sometimes 1 year or 1 year and a half, especially if you are more than 17 and it's not your first time. Now in the Israeli prisons, out of the 8,000 political prisoners that we have, 344 of them, they are juveniles, and they are held, as I said, about 75, they are under age 16, they are held in a special prison for the juveniles, but they also faces the same violations, the daily violations that the other prisoners face, from the entering their room, attacking them by gas, by water, isolating them, sending them to small cells while they will be tied to the bed with their hands and their legs, forbidding them from the family visits, like for 2 months or 3 months sometimes, and they are not getting enough education. Every day they just get 2 hours that a teacher comes from outside to teach them just for 2 hours a day, while the Israeli social or criminal juveniles, they would take a whole day of education inside the prison. And the juveniles between age 16 and 18, they never get any education. Beside the juveniles, the women in prison, we have 119 women arrested in the Israeli prisons. They are located in one prison for the women in two sections. Now they are in a prison mostly for the men, but they are in two different sections, separated from the criminal social women in the women prison in Israel, because there were like lots of troubles between the two sides. In the women prison, the criminal social women were attacking the Palestinian political prisoners by throwing boiled water on them or trying to kick, beat them while they are going outside to the daily vacation, like 2 hours that they have to go outside for the yard. These women, out of them, 19 are mothers. Two of them, they were delivering their babies while they were in jail. One, she was delivering her baby while she was handcuffed, and she was released 2 months ago. The other woman, Manal Ghanem, she's still there with her baby, Noor. He's 1 year and a half. Manal is 29 years old, and she's suffering from thalassemia. She, like Noor, would be taken from his mother within a couple of months when he will finish 2 years. And this is the campaign we are doing now in Damir for the release of Manal. We submitted a petition for the legal, for the military governor and the legal advisor to release her because of the health condition and because of Noor. Because we believe that if Noor would be taken from his mother, he would be affected hardly. He's subjected to the same violations that the mother is facing, so he's very afraid of having any touch with the men. And now he would be taken out to his father that he never met. The father was denied a permission to go inside Israel to visit his wife for 2 years. So Noor doesn't know his father, and now they are taking him away to stay with the father. So we encourage people to send letters through Damir email. You can find a connect through Sumud website, and you'll find more information about the campaign, about the situation of Manal and her family. And please send letters for the Israeli government asking them to release Manal. And this kind of campaigns that usually we do for the either some prisoner who are like facing health conditions, or they have specific case, sometimes we do it for administrative detention. What is the administrative detention? The administrative detention, the Israeli were like using a very old British regulations since the mandate on Palestine. Its security regulations says that they have the authority to send somebody for prison without any charges, without any trial, for different time. And now they are sending people under administrative detention for 6 months, and they can renew these orders for unlimited time. So some people would stay there for years in administrative detention, and they use this policy because it gives them the ability to arrest a huge number of people in the same time. And actually this is what they did in the first Intifada. They arrested more than 8,000 Palestinians in administrative detention. One of them, he was kept there for 8 years. And also they used the administrative detention in the time of Oslo, before the Palestinian Authority came in 1995 and entered the Palestinian cities. They arrested the Palestinian political activists and leaders from the political opposition parties, the Hamas and Jihad and PFLP, TFLP. And they kept them for more than 3 years. Some of them, they stayed there for 4 and 5 years in administrative detention. And they also can use the administrative detention against juveniles between age 16, 18, and against women. Actually, they arrested in 2002 more than 25 juveniles in administrative detention. In 2002, in the reoccupation of the Palestinian cities, they arrested about 15,000 Palestinians. They kept 2,000 of them in administrative detention, and now we have 750 administrative detainees in the prisons. The conditions of the prisoners inside the prisons are terrible because they're suffering daily. Like, the Israelis are using different kinds of humiliation, ill-treatment, abuse their basic rights in order to let them suffer. Like, sometimes they would transfer one prisoner for the 20 prisons inside Israel. Like, every week you will spend it in different prison, and mostly they will use it against the political leaders inside the prisons. So the prisoners cannot arrange their life inside the prison in order to have their own policy to resist against the authorities also violating their rights daily in the prisons. Also, the procedures in front of the military courts, it's totally different from the criminal procedures we are familiar with in the civil system. For example, if you look at the charges described in the charge sheet, you will find something that it's very general. Accusing you, like in late December 2002, you would be sharing in throwing stone. Sometimes you don't know at which day at the month you were throwing stones, or how many times you were throwing stones, or if you shoot it to where they camp. You'll never know when, why, with whom you were. And most of the cases would be built on the confessions of the prisoners themselves that was taken under torture, of course. So what really Damir expect from international community or solidarity movement, how they can support the political prisoners? First, we believe that we have two levels to work in. The first one is the inside the occupied territories, of course, to support these political prisoners directly. And the other level is the international level, by making campaigns. For example, when the prisoners have their own agenda for resistance, like when they have hunger strike, usually we ask people to send letters for the Israeli authorities protesting against the conditions of the prisoners, or making activities as demonstrations, or having hunger strike, like one day hunger strike to support the political prisoners. Sending letter to these prisoners also to support them, to give them the feeling that people are still thinking about them outside. Going to your community to educate more people, going to your political people who you can talk to in order to put pressure in the different government, because we believe the change should come from the people. Without the people enforcing in the international level, enforcing their governments to enforce Israel as a member of the international community, to apply the international law, to fulfill her duty according to the international law, nothing would change with the conditions and the issue of the release of the political prisoners. Thank you.
Good evening, everybody. Thanks for coming for the event. I was born and raised in a refugee camp called Al Amari, which is a refugee camp next to Ramallah. For the translation, I will give you some difficulties because I'm not really following organized structure. So just before I start. Jesus said to his Jews, "The law was made for the servants. I am the Son of God." The distance between my refugee camp and my parents' village is my weakness and my strength. It is a geographical and psychological difference, but it is a life force. In April 2000, the Shabak, Israeli Security Agency, asked me for an interview in Betunia Detention Center. One of the two interrogators said, "You are a smart, educated, and complicated individual. Without Israel, you would have been a simple peasant like your father." I said, "You're absolutely right, but I won't forgive Israel for the fact it did not give me the chance of being a simple peasant like my father." Distance is a whip, the ever-existence mark of power between a master and a slave. The soldier sticks that breaks bones, the shotgun which hunts kids like birds. Israeli prison is a systematical destruction of a person. A whole system is directed to break the strength of an individual. As the Denmark-based International Rehabilitation Council for Torture Victims notes, torture is used to obtain information or confession, to punish or to take revenge or to create terror and fear within a population. The aim of torture is not to kill the victim, but to break down the victim's personality. Each prisoner must go through interrogation. Through this period, the confrontation is based on solitude. The First Intifada shaped a whole generation in which Israel is seen as occupation, and all its manifestation is systematical destruction of the Palestinian existence. Therefore, there is no more obedience to the oppressor. The first time I threw stone at the soldier, I was 11 years old. I reassured my existence by breaking my fear of the of Israeli militants. The occupation is constructed within oneself, but the struggle to overcome one's own oppressor is a continuous process. The struggle in prison starts at the moment when a person gets arrested. It started with me when I refused to say my name. It was in 1990 in Ramallah Detention Center. I was 18 years old, injured, and walking on two crutches. It was my fifth time of being arrested and was my second interrogation. I said to Danny, the interrogator who was accused 2 years later of killing Mustafa Akkawi, "If you don't know my name, why you're arresting me?" Then he made fun of how I got injured and woken in two crutches. The first thing he saw is my crutches as a sign of weakness. Then the crutches became for me a representation of strength. The difference of how crutches meant for both of us is the actual conflict. Crutches are, in my own eyes, a sign of resistance and power, but the crutches, in his own eyes, are a sign of terror and weakness. The gap between both images situated us on opposite sides. He placed a sack on my head and pulled me to a place known as Shabih area. He seated me on a kindergarten chair and tied my hands with plastic ties behind my back with a chair. I was held in this position for 3 weeks. They let me sleep for 6 hours every 7 days. When I used to say my name was an understanding among both of us that I won't confess. But I won't confess not to protect secrets. Rather, it is the only way to free myself from the authority of the occupation. My no to confession is no to obedience and no to slavery. The second day, I was introduced to an interrogator known as Hayim. He wanted to shake hands with me, but I refused. He said, "When two people meet for the first time, they shake hands." I said, "You're right, if they don't know each other, but you are an occupier." He smiled. He placed his hands on my hair and gave me a superior look. I hated him at that moment because he treated me like a little boy while he's torturing me. His superior look reminded me of my childhood, of the fear and the defeat of my parents' eyes. My parents lived in Nakba. When when Palestinians were removed from their homes. This Israel was the undefeated power. They were very authoritative inside the house and extremely obedient to the external authority. The difference between the two sides of their images in my own eyes, what made me throw the first stone at home at the age of 6. They told me a lot of stories about the house and the land that they left. Those stories were a life force. They were detachment of the camp's reality. When the first intifada started, I was 14 years old. My father tried to convince me that I should not be involved because Palestine won't be liberated by stones. I told him the fact that I am living in a refugee camp because you did not resist the occupation. I'm trying to overcome your generation's defeat. The distance that my generation shaped with older generation was a necessary step to resist. Later on, this distance got closer, which made me realize that my father is 30 years older than the state of Israel. My mom, on the other hand, got really involved and got injured twice. Chaim took me from Shabbat around 12 a.m. to interrogator's room. He wrote me a whole list of accusations on the board. It was my sixth day without sleep. Around 2 a.m., he start feeling to sleep, and every few minutes, he wake up and name the list of accusations. At the beginning, I was very happy that I can't sleep. Then I felt really energetic. It is strange how your body surprises you. I called, "Hey, Chaim." He opened his eyes, looked at me, then I pointed my head at the list of accusation and named it while I was laughing. He stood up very angry and started punishing me, shaking my body and squeezing his wedding ring into my face. He said, "If you escape this time, I will kill you outside the prison." I was extremely happy that night because I took the father's figure mask off. He became his real self, a professional killer. At that moment, I asked for trouble, not for pity, but the trouble that I asked for made me overcome my victimization and his oppression. That moment, I wanted to have power over Chaim and the system that he represented through my love. The relation between both of us now is naked and pure, that we are enemies. I wanted to look at my father's eyes and say Israel is not undefeated power, rather Israel is just an ash. When a whole system sets itself to destroy a person, this person either constitute the destruction within and reinforce the power of the system, or this person sets himself free of the system by resisting it. Mahmoud Darwish, which is the national Palestinian poet, said, "Resistance is reassuring of oneself. I say, as well as shaping a distance with the other. This distance makes a prisoner compare to his guard, but not equivalent. I was never equivalent to my guard, because I am searching life while he presents death." Michel Foucault said, "The prison is the only place where power is manifested in its naked state, in its most excessive form, and where it is justified as moral force. I am within my right to punish because you know that it is a criminal to rob and kill." Foucault was mistaken because there is no mutual understanding of what to be a criminal. A Palestinian prisoner starts point that the guard, the prison, and the law are colonized power, then those representations of the system are guilty and destructive force. Ibrahim al-Rai is a Palestinian leader who was assassinated in 1987 during the interrogation in a very brutal way. He was an image of a man who defeated a whole system. One of the interrogators said, "You are not al-Rai." Then I found out that they said the same exact phrase to other prisoners who are not confessing. The death of Ibrahim and his resisting to confession created out of him a myth to his own guards. His death made them small. Ramallah Detention Center was four dimensions journey: Shabih, interrogation room, closet, and a washroom. The closet, known as the refrigerator, is a small cell, less than 1 meter squared, made of rough cement from inside, has a fan, and absolutely dark. The bathroom is where I slept every week for 6 hours, but it is the place where we had our daily needs. One thing Palestinian detainees learned, which do not feel disgusted and all food tastes good. It is strange how struggle takes different forms, the bad taste and the small amount of food, the smell of the washroom while prisoner eating. The struggle is with the system that manifested itself through guards, architecture, architect, weapon, judge, and the washroom. This struggle starts at the moment of being arrested till a person gets released. The interrogation is different ways: 1-to-1, a group of interrogators, 3-to-7, the good guy and the bad guy. The body is the highest tool that a person has, but this body is totally controlled. The restriction reinforces feeling of powerless, where even control over bodily function is in the hands of Israeli police or military. Stolen youth. However, these restrictions did not stop many prisoners of urinating in their pants purposely to regain power over their confession. This control over one's own body shapes different relation and knowledge of the body. A person starts searching for a hidden strength within oneself. There is no break. When the body lives actual pain and suffering, it provides itself with different possibilities to confirm life. When death becomes an actual reality, the body embraces life and it finds its way to smile and laugh. Abu Ghazi, an interrogator, said, "You are too young, the world is still too big. But when the world becomes smaller and you start thinking only of the sack on your head, then we can talk." I said, "Every day I spend here, the world is getting bigger." The filthy sack and the dark cell exclude you from the whole world. Then you stop your tries of stealing glance at the sun. But you develop a simple technique, a way to find the sunrise and the sunset in your own heart. The second phase of the interrogation was in Beit HaTikva, is the headquarters of the Shabak at that time. In this detention center, the interrogation is quite different because it is formed in total solitude. I was placed in a cell that was brightly lit, but they turned the light off for a few days, so it became completely dark. In addition, they eliminated any amount of sugar from my food. Then sugar became a dream. I was introduced to a new executor, Abu Sharif. He told me once that he is the one was in charge of Ibrahim al-Rai's case. I said, "Then you are the one who killed him." "He is the one who eliminated any amount of sugar in my food, but he is the one who kept offering coffee with sugar." It is funny how struggle takes different forms. The physical and the psychological existence of the body asked for sugar, but I was able to say no, the prisoner's food tastes better. He said, "Obviously, you want to die in your cell." I said, "It is a choice." The difference between a shotgun and a stone is the exact difference between a settler and indigenous man. Because I am indigenous, stones appear to be an expression of resistance. For a stone is a mark of a missing land, a missing Byzantine, but it is a self-affirmation. A stone is an expression of the Palestinian resistance as much as a bow and an arrow is an expression of a native warrior. For Palestinian is the unfinished project of the Mohawk, which makes man to be born for standing, not for hanging. A shotgun against a stone is a desensitized man. The sky has been furnished by stone throwing. For Palestinians, made stones fly. Flying stone look from above at the soldier and the arm which throws it and says, resurrection is possible. It extends beyond the soldier's feet. It extends beyond the wall. Beyond the wall. It awakens the spirit of the place, the spirit of Jerusalem. A flying stone confirms one fact, that Palestine is not made for apartheid. Palestine is made for resurrection. A shotgun facing an arrow is the difference between resentment and resistance. An expression of resentment is the death machine in North America, which erased millions of the natives' lives. An expression of resistance is a Mohawk man who fought against his death to death for life. The difference between St. Catharines, where I live at the moment, and Beit HaTikva, which is the prison I had been to, is similar to the distance between my refugee camp and my Beit Afa, my parents' village. The similarity and differences between both distances confirms one fact, that I am a Palestinian refugee. And my refugee state of being brings back Abu Sharif into my present moment, and I say, yes, death is a choice. The death of my body is your highest possibility, but it is my highest possibility too. The difference between both possibilities is life. My death, in your own eyes, is a death of another Palestinian terrorist. My death, in my own eyes, is a total defeat of a system. But when a man defeats a system of death, he's eternal. Thank you very much.